Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Pressure than hoe, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can't none of y'all mirror me back. Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime.
Welcome back, everyone, to a very, very special episode of Miami Nice. I am your co-host, Katie Walsh, and riding shotgun in the Go Fast Boat is the one and only Blake Howard.
Katie, this is really special. Please tell the listeners.
Very special.
Please tell the listeners who they've already seen, perhaps on their podcast feed of choice, who they've maybe seen teased, is joining us today, and more importantly, how they're joining us today.
I have a sordid tale to tell. It's not even sordid, but that seemed appropriate to say. But
yes,
the one and only person that we have said we wanted to get this entire time for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the only person, but he's probably the one that I have wanted to get the most.
I would just say this, most wanted.
Most wanted.
Most wanted guest of Miami Vice, short of perhaps even eclipsing Michael Mann himself.
Yeah.
Is this person.
I mean, I also feel like we've never even been like, yeah, we want Colin Farrell on the pod.
No.
We've
suggested that you tackle him in the street, but
yes.
Perhaps not to be a guest.
We want the disco guy himself. We want John Ortiz. We've The Cochin Loco. We've been saying it from the start. We must get Ortiz. So, this is how we bagged a big one, which is that a few weeks ago, I was at the Independent Spirit Awards, where American Fiction, which is a terrific film that John Ortiz co-stars in, was nominated for a lot of awards, including Best Feature, Best Director, Best Screenplay. Jeffrey Wright won the Best Actor Award. So I'm at the Spirit Awards. Now, you have to understand, the Spirit Awards, they start at like 2 p.m, but you have to get there at 11 a.m. so that you can drink from 11 to 1 in the parking lot of Santa Monica Beach outside of a tent because the awards are held in a tent.
This is the kind of awards that I want to go to.
It's great. It's super fun. And yeah, you got to get there at 11, though, for the cocktails, because it's like a big, like, indie film high school reunion vibe. You're running into all different kinds of people, critics, writers, filmmakers, just everyone who sort of works in this space. And also, I will say that the Indie Spirit Awards are always sponsored by Bullet Bourbon, and they rarely serve food. So everyone is very
drunk.
And
look, if Bullet Bourbon wants to sponsor this podcast,
yes.
If there's any show that shows how powerful for the forces of good Bullet Bourbon can be at 11 a.m., it's this show. Go on.
Thank you, Bullet Bourbon, because I had just the right amount of Bullet Bourbon at noon
to take
on
your
a Sunday.
To take your shot.
So we're making our way into the tent. I see John Ortiz. I'm like, oh my God. I didn't even think about him being there I should have thought about him being there. I didn't even think about him being there. I'm like, holy shit, John Ortiz is here. I go to my table. I'm sitting with friend of the pod and indie cinema queen, Drea Clark.
Love Drea.
You know Drea.
Love Drea.
She's the best. And she also works for Film Independent and is helps put on the show. And so I get there. At this point, my eyes have already turned into a predator. I'm a shark. I'm like, where is John Ortiz? I have to find John Ortiz right now. And Drea, saint and queen that she is, had done the seating chart. She goes, they're sitting at table 208. And I'm like, bye. And I make my way like a barracuda towards table 208. And I see John. He's talking to Judy Reyes, who's like lovely, great actress. She was nominated for an amazing film called Birth Rebirth. They finish talking. And I just go up to John and I say, hi, I'm a big fan of your work. Congratulations on everything. Also, I have this podcast and you are like the number one most important guest that we have ever wanted to have. And he's just the nicest, loveliest person. He was like so warm and friendly. And he, I don't know, there's something about not his performance as Jose Hierro, but in other performances, like on, and I can never remember the name, the Duplass Brothers Eagle Rock show. I can never remember the name of that HBO show that he was on. That American Fiction. I'm just like, me and John Ortiz are going to get along. I know we're going to get along. And he's like nicer and warmer and friendlier than you could ever imagine. And he very kindly gives me his people's information so that we can set up the interview. And he was like, yeah, I really want to talk about it. Like, I really, you know, I haven't had a chance to really talk about my experience on that movie. And like, I really would like to. And he seemed so genuinely interested in doing it. And so I immediately went back to my table. I sent Blake like several unhinged messages in all caps.
I want to see if I can find one, because I couldn't believe, like, I love nothing more than the unhinged.
Then in all caps messages says, Blake, OMG.
Yeah, it's just like a crazy message that like comes streaming through. Where you're like, Blake, all caps, I'm at the spirits. I just saw John Ortiz and had enough daytime bourbon to tackle him.
I didn't actually tackle him.
But I spoke to his people. And I spoke to him and introduced myself and asked him to do the pod, and he said he'd do it. And we were just gushing back and forth at each other. I was so proud of you for doing it. It's so cool that, like, you know, Katie's an amazing film critic who works in LA a lot, and especially around the award season, you're such sought after talent to help curate and moderate Q&As, etc. And so it's so cool that you sometimes see these people, but we have this very weird niche, this patch for us where we get lots of great and wonderful guests, but they don't necessarily have to be tied to the thing that we're talking to all the time. But then someone like John Ortiz, like, he's out there just like doing great work. Everyone loves him in everything that he's in. He's like universally the thing that people love in things, even if they don't like it. And he so rarely gets the flowers to be gushed at. And so I imagine it would have been kind of weird for him to like get a request to just do some random show. But so cool that he met you. And what you guys are going to hear, because we want to hurry up and get to this, but we only, you know, his publicists and his people, they do their best to protect their talent from like, okay, we don't know really what this is. We don't know what the vibe of it is. So, you know, we're going to give him an out and say that he can only do like 30 minutes. We, of course, wanted an hour with him. Like an hour and 10 minutes into the interview,
We barely started talking about the movie.
We barely got like, we got like two amazing lengthy stories, or two or three maybe. We're like, should we let you go? And he goes, no, I definitely want to come back because there's more that I have to say. And I can't wait for you to hear it. We had this sensational time talking to him. He is one of the loveliest guys I think we've ever spoken to on the show. Forget that he's a great actor, and forget this is a monumental performance from him that makes the movie. He's just such a talent. He's also a four-time Michael Mann collaborator, which puts him in such rarefied air. He does Vice, he does Public Enemies, he does Black Hat. All the frothy soy boys out there, yes, we got a Black Hat star and a Vice star and a Public Enemy star and a Luck star. And he talks about that. He talks about being spotted by Michael Mann. He talks about, you know, he talks about his career up to that point. It's an amazing conversation. He is an absolute legend. And we just can't wait for you to hear it because it's so sensational.
Yeah, I'm on like a John Ortiz high. I just think he's like the sweetest person. And this whole week I've been excited to talk to him. I think we both felt like it was Christmas morning. So
a delight.
It was great.
A delight. All right, guys. Here's Jose Yura. And right now, as my friend Jed Ayers said, today we're all disco guys. So, John, I'm going to spare you a really effusive, gushy introduction. We'll just record that after the fact because we don't want to make you blush too hard. But as I said, we're a gigantic...
Oh, bring it on. Come on.
All right, let's do it. No. Here we go.
I don't know if you can tell, but Blake is wearing his Miami Vice crew shirt.
This is a crew shirt for Miami Vice.
Authentic from the shoot.
Were you on the crew?
No, one of the editors, we did a live screening of Miami Vice and a sound editor joined us and befriended us and then asked for Katie and I an address and sent us like all the way to Australia because I'm in Sydney, sent us both t-shirts from original crew t-shirts and they are like our most prized possessions.
Awesome. That's like the real deal too.
It is.
It's authentic from 2005.
I'm texting my wife who's in the other part of the house to see if she can scrounge up a cool t-shirt that I received, which is kind of embarrassing that I have it, but I wore it out in public once, but I got to show it to you.
I'm very excited to see it.
Yeah. Maybe that'll come in. Speaking of Christmas and Santa Claus.
We are just so thrilled to have you here. I know when I introduced myself to you at the Spirit Awards, which thank you for receiving me so graciously and so warmly, this random woman approaching you and saying, please come on my podcast. But you are truly the one person that we have desperately wanted to have on. I think we've been doing this podcast for 4 years. And ever since the beginning, we've been saying, We got to get John Ortiz. So you are our white whale that we have landed.
Michael Mann, forget it. John Ortiz, numero uno.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I thank you for that. I must say that when you approached me, I just couldn't say no. You were just dripping with authenticity and just this wonderful quality that that is just real.
Thank you.
And so, yeah, I just couldn't say no. So thank you for that. And I love Miami Vice. I love my experience on it. I just, you know, there are so many wonderful people that want to talk to. I find it hard to believe that I'm on the top of that list.
We're just very obsessed with your performance and with the character of Jose Yura. And, you know, we've watched the movie so many times that we just really lock into certain moments. And I just rewatched the movie, but only the Jose Yura scenes. So, and there's
the
some
Ortiz
of the most,
cut.
The Ortiz cut. So we're just really take it. I mean, there's so many great people in the movie, but you just bring such a certain specific flavor and like intensity and, you know, specific character to Jose Yura that we just like kind of lock into these very specific things. That's why we love your performance so much.
Well, thank you. And here we go. You ready?
Oh, you ready?
Yes.
Ready.
I mean, the folks can't see this.
Oh my God.
Oh, wow. Wait. Oh, it says I'm a disco guy. Oh my God.
John.
So just describing.
You wore that? Okay, guys. It is the 1980s. Miami Vice font. It says Jose Yura. It's got three, like a three-headed Cerberus of John's face in different expressions. And then underneath it says, I'm a disco guy. And you wore that out in public? Oh my God.
I wore it out in public because on the day that I finally agreed to see Barbie with the family, we're heading out the door and my son is head to toe in pink. My wife is about head to waist in pink, and I'm walking out in gray.
No.
And so they were like, come on, you gotta join us. I'm like, of course I do, but I don't think I have anything pink. And a light bulb went off, and I was like, wait a minute. Someone sent me a t-shirt a few months ago, and I think it's somewhere buried in my bottom drawer. And there it was. So I put that on, and I was so embarrassed that I think I might have put it inside out because I didn't want, you know. But
you're
then,
wearing
like,
the shirt with your face. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did have the pink, and I might have, like, you know, on the way back, turned it around because of my Jose Yaro pride.
That's amazing.
You should have pride. Let's go, because we've got this time with you, we just have to go right back to the start. We like, talk to us. It's sort of 2004-05. This movie starts to materialize. Just tell us, this is a document, a sacred document for us talking to you. So we just want to know everything. You're right at this time, starting to pop off in television, starting to pop off in movies. You obviously had a massive career already on the stage, you know, in different ways. But can you just tell us about how this movie came across, how it piqued your interest, how you sought out for it? Tell us everything. We'd love to hear.
All right, I'll tell you everything. First of all, on the surface, my big break is, by all accounts, the very first movie I did, which was kind of splashy. Carlito's Way, opposite Al Pacino. And I was lucky enough that the role was young and not super big, that someone with absolutely no credits can get a shot at it. And luckily, I got the role of a lifetime. To start things off. But quickly after, and it was a combination of starting my own theater company and also working with Peter Sellers, the theater and opera director, Peter Sellers, not Pink Panther, and in a couple of plays in Europe, and the second of which I met Philip Seymour Hoffman, did I realize how much I loved doing theater. And how much, how varied and much more interesting the roles were and the projects and the collaborative nature of, I think, why I decided to become an actor for real. It was never about fame or money. So that was like between 92, when I started the company, I had my first film in 93, and then 93, 94, I was doing these 6-month world tours with Peter Sellers. And in between, I was lucky enough to still do a couple of films here and there and some TV stuff. But I was mostly doing theater. And in 2004. I did do quite a bit of films afterwards, but there was never, because I was mostly concentrating in theater for those next 10 to 12 years, I was still considered a theater actor.
Yeah.
I was in New York and I was making a living at it with enough film credits to my name. I did Narc. I worked with Spielberg and Amistad. I worked with Ron Howard. But again, I was mostly considered a theater actor. And so I feel like my Miami Vice was like another huge break.
Yes.
For me. Something in my age, and I felt like I had done those 10 to 12 years of theater. I had just gotten married. I actually bought a house because at the time I had done a pilot that was picked up, and I was just convinced that I just wanted to buy a house. I thought that was the thing to do. And I was ready to concentrate more in film and TV, but I couldn't say no to this wonderful play called Last Days of Judas Iscariot by my friend Stephen Ali Girgis and directed by Phil Hoffman, and playing the role of Jesus.
Wow.
And opposite Sam Rockwell, who was playing Judas Iscariot. And it was, you know, the cast was like between 16 and 18 actors, and we were all friends, and it was just a wonderful, wild theatrical experience. During that experience, I got the audition for Miami Vice, and I was in New York. And in fact, I went to the casting office in between shows. We had a matinee that day, and in between shows, I went, I did the audition, and came right back to the theater. About a week, maybe 2 weeks later, I find out that he wants me to read. I auditioned for Yarrow, and he wanted me to read for the boss. Forgot the character's name.
Archangel de Jesus Montoya.
Yeah,
Luis Tosar plays.
Yeah, wonderful actor, Spanish actor Luis, and he wanted me to read for that part.
Wow.
And he wanted also for me to wear the same thing I wore for the Jose Hierro audition, which was a brown suit jacket. So after the performance at night, I had a good friend who was in the cast record me and tape me because I couldn't fly to LA.
Yeah.
Which is what Michael's first choice was. And I was doing a play, so I couldn't fly back. That was another great thing about my early part of my career in doing a lot of theater was I was unavailable a lot of times for film because the runs of plays were so long, and I was okay with it because I was single and I was you know, happy doing those plays. But what it accomplished in a weird way was people on the West Coast in film and TV being just a little more intrigued by me. I was like the guy that was never available, who was always doing theater, you know? So it actually turned out to be a cool thing. So
playing
it was
hard
nice,
to get.
Playing hard
yeah,
to get.
Yeah, playing hard to get. So Michael understood, and he was like, okay, put yourself on tape. And this is, you know, back in the olden days when self-tapes weren't really a thing. But there were camcorders. So my friend recorded me. And honestly, I had no interest to play that part. Even though, like, well, I would have probably done it. I really wanted to be in the movie. I really wanted to work with Michael. I had started to dive into Michael Mann world. And I was like, wow, this is the kind of director I would love to work with. I was also a bit like envious of like Phil's relationships with some directors like Paul Thomas Anderson, and like I wanted my Paul Thomas Anderson.
Nice. You know?
So I was like, he would be a good my Paul Thomas Anderson, this my, this Michael Mann guy. So I would have done the angel part.
Yeah.
However, I gave it all. I gave it my all. And I found the perfect Jose Hierro shirt, costume piece. So at the end of the audition, I was like, Michael, with all due respect, that's what I did with Angel, and it'd be an honor to play the part, but I just can't get Jose Hierro out of my mind. And I can't get him out of my mind so much that I have this shirt that I would like to put on. And by that point, I'm taking off the suit and I'm putting on the Jose Hierro shirt that I would like to put on and just give you one more go at Jose Hierro. And I went right into the Jose Hierro scene.
And what scene was it? Do you remember what?
It was the big scene, the first intro.
Oh, okay. Where he's interrogating the guys about.
Yeah.
Okay. Amazing.
Yeah. It was that scene. And I had it pretty down because I was spending a lot more time working on that scene just for fun than the scene that he really wanted me to prepare. So I guess it worked because a few weeks later, I got the part.
Amazing. So what good. About the Jose Euro glasses? I feel like those really make the character. Was that a choice from the costume designer or a choice from you?
I think that was a Michael choice.
Okay.
That was a Michael choice. I'm not sure if it was written. I have a feeling it was, but if not, it was quickly agreed upon that we should have some glasses for him. Something else that happened before I even started was after getting the part, I had finished the run of the play and I was working in Toronto on a movie called Take the Lead. And Michael wanted to meet with me. And he was already in Miami. He was in pre-production. I only had like 24 hours. So they flew me to Miami from Toronto and I had to, you know, head back the next morning. So I go and it's all to meet Michael for the first time in person. And I am so excited. I'm like nervous. Like people are like coming up to me, people like in the office, like his assistant and some of the producers, as if I'm somebody. I'm nobody. I like, you know, like
I've been watching that tape for weeks.
Something, but maybe it was just like, who is this theater nerd? And so, but you know, they're making me feel comfortable, like welcomed, all of the good things that's like making my initial excitement over meeting Michael Mann like become positive, right? Because it's very easy for that kind of energy of excitement to go south and turn into, you know, a puddle of nerves and stuff like that. But in fact, it was like, it was reaffirming, right? It was like, yeah, I kind of belong here and I'm like really excited to meet with him. And I'm waiting and I'm finally called into his office. And he said, we say hi to each other, we greet each other. And he mentioned something about NARC. And that's like the one credit I remember him mentioning. Not that I had a whole bunch of credits, but that's the one where, and that's a whole other story that I have about NARC. But it was really cool because NARC, in fact, was my first direct offer. I didn't to audition. And it was only because they had seen me in this play called Jesus Hop the A-Train. And it was one day of work. And I go up to Toronto. It's an independent movie. It's like, if I felt like they needed help in completing it. But I had a great time shooting it. I shot it in 6 hours. And I'm on a plane to go to LA to promote this TV show that I was on with Dennis Leary called The Job. But I was just, I literally was like wishing them good luck. I was like to Joe Carnahan and like the skeleton crew that they had. Little did I would ever expect, you know, that film would not only go to Sundance, Tom Cruise would see it, convince Paramount Studios to pick it up, and it would have a healthy run, enough of a healthy run for Michael Mann to see it. But then Michael Mann, 3 years later, to say, you really stood out to me in that movie.
Wow.
Was kind of mind-blowing. And that exchange was probably 1.7 seconds. Because it was like my mind was going a mile a minute, and he was like, you know, this this god in front of me, and I'm in his office, and he's also talking kind of fast. So it was like a blur, and I was like constantly telling myself, just slow down, just slow down, and soak it all in, soak it all in. So he sits me down, and he then, for the next 2 to 3 hours, goes through Miami Vice, what his vision is for it, Jose Hierro, the culture, all these different cities, all these real people that have inspired a lot of things in what he's envisioning this movie to be. And for those 3 hours, I started to take notes, but gave up because he was just super fast, and like from one thing to another, he was just like ricocheting all this information that I was just like, okay, I think the pen to paper thing is getting in the way. And he just tried to like concentrate really hard on hearing every word. And hopefully hopefully something will stick, so that when I get back to the hotel, I can like jot some stuff down. But it was all like great. I mean, it was inspired stuff, not only creatively, but from an actor's point of view. I never really had a director speak to me with film up to that point in such an actor-centric, friendly way.
Mm-hmm. And just giving you a mountain of stuff to work with. You can go back and play, right?
Mountain of stuff, and it was juicy. It was juicy stuff, you know, that you can really kind of chew on, and like stuff that you can chew on that wasn't necessarily result oriented, but would like help fire off other ideas as an actor, you know. And that's what was really exciting and kind of rare when it comes to coming from a director. You know, the good ones know how to do that, but it's not easy, you know. And so that was happening for 3 hours. We ended. It was so great. I was mostly just kind of yesing him to death. And I think I might have gone back to the hotel. I had a fitting. I had a fitting then. And I then went to the hotel, ordered a cheeseburger, and had to wake up early for the flight. And I'm kicking myself because I'm not really remembering half of what he told me. So I get in the car to get to go to the airport, and the driver gets a call, and it says to take John to the office. There's an envelope for him there that he should have with him. And I'm like, all right, but I'm going to be late to the, you know, I don't want to miss my flight, you know, and they really needed me back in Toronto. So we stop at the airport, at the office, which is on the way to the airport, and I get a manila envelope that's kind of heavy. And I run back, I say goodbye to folks. I didn't see Michael. It was his assistant who gave it to me. Get in the elevator, go in the car, go to the airport. I had put it in my bag, so I didn't open it right away. Until I'm on the plane. And on the plane, I saw when I'm going through to get whatever it is that I was looking for in my bag, I see the envelope. And I open the envelope, and what's in the envelope? But about, I don't know, 50 to 75 pages, transcribed pages of the meeting.
Wow.
Highlighted with all the things that I thought were juicy and great and that I forgot.
It's the dossier. It's the dossier.
I swear Michael Mann's assistant team are like a group of angels who are all born from stenographers in courtrooms who can just sit there and transcribe faster than is humanly possible.
Oh my God, the transcriptions.
Because he does that. All the teams, all these units, we've heard stories from him firsthand, John, and stories from people who work with him. Just like he'll sit there in a meeting, say stuff. Usually there's a dictaphone there. His assistants and team transcribe it and send those notes out for the departments. You know, we talked about editing here. Okay, cool. We talked about sound here, mixing. We talked about like picture cut here. We talked about coloring here. And then they go and deploy the notes. But I'd never heard it for like the actor's juicy meeting, which is amazing for you. Cause then you get to go, you've just got like you've got a character Bible, 75 pages after one meeting.
Yeah. And that was my first impression of Michael Mann.
And were you then intimidated to start shooting or excited or, you know, you were like, let's go, let's do this.
You were like, this is my Paul Thomas Anderson. You call your friend Bill Hoffman, and you're like, I found him.
I found him. Yeah, I was truly inspired to dig in and it's funny because when friends saw the movie initially, and I would get mostly positive reactions from them, I heard more than once how they loved that I took a character that is usually played one way or is not super deep, and there was all this depth to him. Mm-hmm. And you know, I can't take all the credit for that. You know, that was like, that all started with that meeting. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, like, I mean, I have to be an idiot to sit through 3 hours and see that transcription and read it and understand what he was going for and think, oh yeah, this is just a drug dealer that we've seen
We'll be right back after this quick break.
He's not just a middleman, Jose Yarrow. Like, he's got a lot of simmering stuff happening underneath that facade. I mean, he does do sort of the bureaucracy and the moving around and the running of the clubs and all this stuff. But I love the scene where he's watching them dance on the monitor, and it just, you feel the sort of simmering rage underneath him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with that, I mean, that was like one of the stage directions, one of the descriptions that people might read over that Michael wrote. And it said, it might've been the first time he sees the character, or maybe not in that scene, but earlier. And he wrote Jose, what was Gong Li's character's name?
Isabella.
Jose may or may not be in love with her, you know, and she doesn't know it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
it's a lovely little turn of phrase, may or may not, and then that gets your brain going. Oh, okay. Like, is this kind of my, in that weird family? Because I think also Archangel and Jose and Isabella have a weird family dynamic, which I love, which is like, is it kind of like my my stepmother boss weird relationship, or is it like I'm in this position of number two for so long, and I'm always looking at what number one has, and number one has Isabella, and number one has this compound, and number one doesn't show any emotions, it's just so clinical, and you can see he's always reaching for that. But all of the stuff that you let out, John, that you let all of who Jose is out is the stuff that everyone, you talk about the word juicy, but that's the juicy stuff that we go back and look at your performance countless times and go, oh, he is just cooking here. Because it's that, it's, you get, it's all the bleed through of what you actually want and not getting it. And you, it being withheld from you, I think that's what I love so much personally about your performance.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, and part of that was also like, there's another layer to the may or may not be in love with her. And that's that she doesn't care.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
To even, she has no time for it. And then also because he has worked his whole life to climb the ladder and desperately wants to be the guy, he knows that he can't ever show that. He can't ever have that be revealed. So in that moment, in that scene, I really wanted to search for when it is, you know, and it's written that he's watching her dance with him from afar, but that's it.
Right.
And so much so that the B camera unit was actually filming it.
Yeah.
Michael wasn't
oh,
there.
Okay. I mean,
he was on location, but he wasn't watching.
Okay, yeah.
He was capturing the dance, which was so beautiful and magical and everything and cinematic, right? And it was like, it was Michael's wheelhouse. Like, the shot of me was like, just put a camera there and have John at the far end and just have him look. But I was like, this is the fucking moment. This is it. But like, you know, so luckily I didn't have the pressure of like Michael Mann being like, you know, giving me all this direction or like people waiting to get the next shot. We were just kind of like off to the side. And we did maybe two takes. And I'm working with I wish I could remember his name, but great camera guy. It's just me and him. And I could tell after the first take, something kind of amazing happened. And he comes over to me, which he never does. It was like, that was fucking great. Let's do it just one more time. But I think that was amazing. And so we did it. And I might have maybe pushed it even maybe a little more, just had a little more going on. And but the key was, I have to feel all this love, but I can't show it. I can't show it. Oh, fuck, it's coming out, but I can't show it. That was the key for me. So we were done. The camera guy coming over to me was like a big win for me. Mm-hmm. Like, that never happens where, you know, you get that immediate response, you know, and it was immediate and it was real and he was so excited. And I was like, well, I guess that was pretty good. a couple of nights later, I don't know why, but I don't know if I was shooting something, like, but it was off hours and we weren't on set. We were near the production office and I needed to get something, or I was with someone who needed to get something. And we walked into the production office. It was actually like a weekend, and Michael was coming out and outside the building, and we crossed paths, and it was like a major deal for me and for me with in regards to him whenever we interacted, because I was still like, it's the first time I'm working with him, you know, so it's like any little, it was kind of like very careful, or like, you know, what did that look mean when he looked in my direction? And like, did he say hi to me? Like, does he like me? Am I doing okay? Am I going to be fired? You know, like all that stuff, you know, he's Michael fucking Mann.
Yeah.
and we cross paths, and it's like a weekend, we're off hours. I'm like, I wonder how this is going to go. And he stops me and he's like, really warmly, and he's like, hey, I saw the dailies from the disco night. That was really good.
Wow.
And I was like, holy shit. Yeah, yeah. So anyway.
That's awesome.
That moment, it not only lives in the finished product as something kind of cool, but that whole story of how we did it and what happened and Michael not being there, but then seeing him dailies, and was extra special.
Yeah. Well, it's so fascinating that like you have this amazing story, and it's a moment that we think about all the time that really came across so beautifully. I'm curious if you have a favorite Jose Yarrow line, because we have some favorite Jose Yarrow lines. or you know, like, is it I'm a disco guy? Is it I like when you are at the end out when you're like, maybe we take her out, we grab a bite, we go to the movies, like that's what we want.
She mine now.
Yeah.
I love both those. I love both. But you know, it's funny because like when I got the line, the disco line was pretty, the script changed a lot all the time.
Okay.
Michael was constantly rewriting, and the disco line though was pretty much there the whole time. And like, honestly, when I read it, I was like, this line is weird. I don't get it, you know, like, but you know, but what was interesting about it is like, it was kind of an acting thing. It's like, as long as you know what you're doing, it doesn't matter. Like nothing else really matters as much as we think it does.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how it comes out. It doesn't matter why, you know, it's just like, just be on top of what it is that you're doing and who you are. Right. And, mm-hmm. and I leaned into that, you know, like I let that become more important to me thinking the actual words were weird. You know, it's like when you're learning lines, the reason why it's sometimes hard, or you know, it can be difficult to learn a chunk of lines, speeches, if you're going in it cold, is because you may not know what you're doing at that point. But once you figure that out, the words start becoming second nature without you working at actually memorizing it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so like, I think that's what happened in that scene. Like we were in a real disco, like it felt like we were out and it's South Beach, you know, at 3 in the morning, and you know, and we were living it up, And we could hardly hear each other and stuff. And I just wanted to push buttons, you know, and to find some stuff out, and just say shit and take in the actual music that's going on in the environment. And that came out. Mm-hmm. And so that's become one of my favorite lines because of that, the yes. process of how I came to that realization as an actor, but also because how many people actually love the line.
Yes.
You know,
I think it's so one cool. of
I mean, so,
the most iconic
so much
lines.
So that it's on a t-shirt.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, you're a longtime New Yorker. Yeah. So I imagine that like on a subway or something like that, occasionally it's like, you know, I'm a disco guy too. You know, like I can imagine that like people just subtly, if they spot you, you know, that might be one of the first things that people say.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I've had that. No. I think I have, but I'm not sure if it's been in New York or not. It might have been down under.
There you go. If I saw you in the street, John, I would be the worst person. I'm sorry in advance if I ever do see you in person. I'll be like, oh my God. Yeah. I'll freak out. People around will be like, what is going on?
The other lines with the I'll take her out to the movies, we'll grab a bite to eat, we'll check out a movie. That was written like the night of, pretty much.
Oh.
And wow. That whole section, that the whole ending, you guys probably know this, but it was reworked because we couldn't go back to South America to do the original ending. And so Michael was working really hard at like coming up with a new ending. And part of that new ending was Jose Yarrow's death, you know, and what leads up to it. And so during the shooting of that, because it was a lot of action, when we shot my side of it, we rehearsed it, we shot it once or twice, and then he would like throw new lines at me. And then, because at first it was really wide, and then, you know, you come in and as he's coming in for my close-ups, you know, he had like multiple cameras, but it was still getting to the point where it's like, okay, this is now going to be on you. He takes me over with the script in his hand, which he always has, and a million notes and stuff. And he's like, okay. And it's like a whole page, an entire page with mostly Jose Yarrow lines. He's like, okay, I want you to take this section. I want you to put it over here. And then that section over there, put it over here, but only take half of that and put it over here. And I'm just like, Michael, are you serious? And this is by the end. So I'm like, I'm feeling a little more comfortable with him.
Yeah.
You know? At the beginning of the shoot, I probably would have said like, okay. But at that point, it was the end. I was like, are you serious? He's like, yeah, why? He's like, well, because it's my close-up now, and we've set it the other way around, and that's how I know it, and all this. And he's like, oh, don't worry, we'll have time. We, you know, I'll make sure that we get it. And I'm like, I grab, you know, a pen, and I'm changing stuff around. And that was one of the new lines that came in. And again, I thought it was like, just, I guess because I was in it as much as I could be. Like that whole experience, the whole film from beginning to end, and there was a lot of distractions throughout, but from beginning to end, I had probably the most artistically gratifying experiences of my career.
Wow.
On a purely work level. And I think because of that, and because I was like so in it, I didn't judge how ironic or how funny or lines that came out of his mouth were. I just like found ways that made sense to who he was as honestly and as personally and as intimately as possible. Mm-hmm. And so in retrospect and in hearing people's reaction of it, you know, I'm now able to be like, yeah, that is a crazy line, or that's a funny line. And I'm able to have it, but only because there's now distance to it. But at the time, even when we did it, because there were a lot of other actors there and they heard it, you know, I was being pretty loud because Colin was on the other side and stuff, and I was yelling it pretty much. But I had actors come up to me and they were like, oh my God, that is so great. Oh my God, that's so funny. That's so good. Oh man, your character is awesome. You know, and I'm just like, whatever, you know, I'm just trying to remember all these changes that Michael's throwing at me.
I cannot believe he did that to you. Like, it's middle of the night, you're on location, there's like a million guns around. I'm sure you had to do a ton of gun training just to shoot that scene. And he's like, okay, just change this speech all around and put this over here. Like, that's wild.
Yeah. And that's his style too. He's just like inspired, like, and he's not afraid to let go of predetermined expectations and things of how he thought they should go, you know. And if something goes off in his brain about an idea, then he has no problem with going for it in a completely different way. You know, he's infamous for doing that with wardrobe. Where you know, there's a tie that, you know, I might have been wearing for the entire movie, and there's one scene where he sees it a certain way. He's like, nah, that's not the right tie. And he'll have the whole wardrobe department come in with a lot of other options. And we're there in between takes trying on new ties. You know, it's just something about the picture. There's something about the feeling that one tie gives him that he would rather go for than, you know, be worried about something as boring as continuity.
It's more about the vibes than the continuity.
We could not care less about continuity.
And the search, you know, it's all about the search and the exploration and just figuring it all out, you know, because at the end of the day, who the hell knows?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, when he does have a connection with any element that supports his vision, he is as relentless as anyone in going for it. So with Yarrow, in that first meeting, even like when he was talking about his history and his education, you know, there was this academic kind of grad school vibe that he wanted to explore, and that's maybe when the glasses came up. Mm-hmm. That you asked about earlier. And so we like spent hours looking for the right pair of glasses because we felt that was really right. You know, there was something about my hairstyle and how he loved the length of it. But it was all about finding the right style for it. And I remember him saying like, yeah, he wishes he had the access to a really fancy salon or hairstyle stylist, but he does it.
Mm.
But he does it himself, and he's, because he has other stuff going on, and he's not an expert at it. He only sees what's in front of him.
Yes.
So let's just spend a lot of time with like the front, and the back is just like not
untamed,
touched.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And so the front was like, and we spent hours with the front of my hair, you know, the top of my hair and the sides, going through it with all different kinds of products. And then we settled on something that with that particular product would form these gaps and these waves in my hair that he would affectionately call, once he saw it, and that was it, he would call them rivers.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so Jose Hierro has the Michael Mann entitled Rivers haircut, you know. And so every day I showed up and in the makeup and hair trailer, it was like I sat down and was like, okay, let's get those rivers going.
I mean, now I want to know the hair story of every character in Miami Vice. First and foremost, Sonny's hair story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That beautiful mullet.
Colin would have a... Yeah, we have to ask Colin about that.
Okay, well, just give us his number and we'll ask him.
We'll text him after the call. It's fine. We'll give him a call.
Let's see here.
So can we just talk about like the crazy cast on this movie? Because I'm not sure if you realize this, John, but I certainly do, because I affectionately call myself this like a Michael Mann psycho. You've worked with Michael Mann in 3 films. So has Barry Chewbacca Hanley, so has Bruce McGill, so is Jamie Foxx, but you've also worked on the Lux series, which makes you like a 4-time man collaborator. And I have to talk to you about the chemistry of this cast, because like there are so many amazing, like, and not just like such as yourself being cast too. It's not all the obvious people. Obviously, you got the top line guys, and they were really at the peak of their fame at the time with Colin and Jamie, and then Gong Li, like at the peak of her fame internationally in cinema. But then you've got this amazing cast around you, some of which folks who join you in later movies, like our boy Dominic Lombardozzi, who joins you on Public Enemies, and you guys work together pretty closely again. So can you tell me about like what it was like working with those folks? And like, I mean, I know it was a pretty chaotic set, but are there any stories you've got you remember of like just working with the team and the vibe of the set at the time? Because it feels like you grew in comfort and confidence with Michael, but I'd love to, if you could share any stories of just like working with that whole group of actors, even Luis Tosa, who is Luis Tosa, because, you know, he just seems wonderful as well.
Yeah, I mean, you could really go from top to bottom of that cast list and really just kind of say wow, you know. Naomi Harris, Chewbacca, Chewbacca Henley, who's great and amazing, Elizabeth Rodriguez, here's a cool little trivia. In the play that I was doing when I auditioned, Last Days of Judas Iscariot, Elizabeth was one of the 16 or 18 cast members in that play. So she found out that she was cast while we were doing the run of it as well.
Amazing.
And she's pretty amazing. She's got that great moment with the... Mm-hmm. In the trailer park. You know, that cast, you know, again, it was like the excitement of working on a Michael Mann movie. Something as iconic as, you know, Miami Vice, because of the TV show, that we were in Miami timed perfectly with where I was at in my life, with just like a new chapter beginning. You know, like I mentioned, I was like ready to make the switch to mostly film and TV at that time. And mostly because I had just bought a house that I couldn't afford. but I was ready, you know, and open and so excited. And then seeing the cast, knowing that Jamie Foxx had just won the Oscar. Mm-hmm. Colin was Colin Farrell at the time. He was like one of the biggest young male Hollywood stars. And it seemed like a perfect match. Gong Lee. And then all these like guys that I was about to become as well, which were like Michael Mann veterans.
Yes.
Who knew the deal. So there was like this great, mix of actors that were game, that were all game, and that were all like fully loaded to to deliver, you know, just chomping at the bit. John Hawks,
yes,
yeah,
is another one. And so we spent, there was a nice, and the budget was big enough to support us being around for several weeks before we started shooting. And it was epic as well. So you had this great mix, this great large mix of actors from kind of all over, you know. It's the wonderful Irish actor as well.
Kieran Hines.
Yeah. Kieran, you know, from all over the world, right? In different stages in their career, telling this somewhat simple, small story in a really kind of epic way, you know. That was really pushing boundaries. So it felt like we were all part of the same unit, but because it was so big, we were also like kind of like different camps. Yeah. In a way, you know. Even in shooting, like there were times when, because Jose Hierro was pretty much on his own.
Yeah.
But the squad unit, like they were always together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like whenever they were in Miami, I often went back and forth from Miami to back home. And I would hear stories and I would run into people, and it was like, and I wanted to know what I missed, you know, because of the night shoots that we had, which were plenty.
Yes.
We, especially during those big shootout scenes, we would be done when the sun came out, and we had so much adrenaline that we would just chill out at the pool.
Oh, nice.
For breakfast, you know, and just kind of like come down from that high of like 12 hours that we were out there shooting guns and running from each other and that kind of stuff. And so we got fairly close, and then because there were many reshoots and stoppage because of the Hurricane Central that we were under that glorious summer of 2005. I think there were like five or six hurricanes that,
oh my God,
went through Miami that summer. So there was a lot of stoppage, you know? And so we would just have to like hang out. And so we would often go to dinners and just tell stories. I have some great Cuban food, and so I got really close with Chewbacca. He's still a really good friend of mine. I knew Elizabeth from the theater days, and I see her a lot these days as well. Colin and I have remained friends.
Oh, that's great.
I did our very next movie that we both did was actually, I think I squeezed one in before that one, but it was Pride and Glory.
Wow.
That was Colin's very next movie. I did a film called El Cantante, mm-hmm. Between Vice and Pride and Glory. But Colin and I, so the cast felt like there were sections of the cast, like clusters of the cast that bonded throughout the whole thing. And if you didn't, it was only because you were flying in and out too often, you know, but it was impossible to be there. And we mostly all stayed at the same hotel. So, you know, we would see each other all the time. And like, so many wild things were happening that it was just, it was impossible to not be like, I got to check in with someone and be like, you know, what's going to happen? Like, you know, Hurricane Katrina's on her way, you know, we have no production office and, you know, it's been blown to smithereens, you know, like what's going to happen, you know? So like, so there were often like, you know, we're going to have a whole brand new ending to this movie. Like what's going to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of just, bonding over new territory that we were all in, you know, and making this crazy wild film.
Well, I mean, kind of, I could listen to stories about, you know, shooting all day, but you know, our podcast is really about why people have sort of started to embrace this film again, you know, some 15, 20 years later, and how it's sort of been rehabilitated as a masterpiece. And it sounds like you got that Jose Hierro shirt a couple years ago. And I'm just curious, like, have you been aware of people coming around to this film and sort of younger generations embracing it and the new appreciation that people have for this? And what has it been like for you to kind of hear about people who are just discovering it now?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I haven't really been as much on top of the resurgence of its popularity. I kind of have like picked up a little bit, you know, with folks saying, "Oh, I saw that for the first time," and then being surprised at how much they enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that happens with some other films that I've been in, you know, like it's actually happening now a bit with The Drop, which I thought was a really great film.
Sensational film. And it's now 10 years old this year. So,
yeah. And like, and folks, you know, it didn't get its proper due, right? Yeah. And like, there are a lot of movies that don't, you know, there's just a lot of movies and people don't have a lot of time, you know, to see them all when they're quote unquote supposed to see it. You know, but I think with Miami Vice, it was different. Like, and in terms of why it didn't hit when it hit, and I think the big reason is that folks were expecting something else. Yeah. You know, they were expecting possibly a cheesy, you know, TV adaptation. You know, a movie adaptation of a popular TV show,
right?
That we've seen during a specific era, mm-hmm. Not too long ago, where there were like a string of those that,
yeah, they
a
had
a lot of people saw and became box office hits, and
had, like a Charlie's Angels,
yeah, Charlie's Angels,
Starsky and Hutch,
yeah, exactly, and folks were really expecting that when they heard, oh, Miami Vice. With Jamie Foxx and Colin Farrell. Yeah, it's going to be something like that. And that was never the intention.
Never.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Michael says he has no regrets except one, and that's calling it Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He told me once. He might have said that to some other folks as well. But I agree with him. You know, I think people just, that's what they expected because that's what was coming out. That type of stuff was coming out at that time. So it was very easy to think this was just going to be another version of that. So I was greatly disappointed because I, like I said, I had the time of my life and it was extraordinarily gratifying artistically for me. Like it's like I still look back and I'll sometimes try to summon up things that helped me during that time that I might have forgotten. You know how we do that from, you know, I wish I was as optimistic
in my yes
in my old age as I was as a 17-year-old, you know, about to conquer the world. You know how you know, so sometimes I like to think I live a pretty good life and I'm very lucky and I don't have many regrets, you know, but of course I'm human and there are times where things might be a little more difficult than others and I'll think about certain points in my career when I was working on specific projects and I'm like, and I need help, you know, I'm like I would like to, you know, approach this the way I did then. Like, what was it about that time period? And what did I do that I might be overlooking right now, you know? And so Miami Vice, from that flight from Toronto to Miami, that meeting, every time I was on set, every time I was at the hotel, like prepping, like everything was just, I mean, it was just like, I fucking nailed it. To the ability of like I gave it my all,
yeah,
right. And so when I saw the movie, I was like, this is great.
Yeah,
this movie is fucking really, really good.
Yeah.
And even at the premiere in Miami, I had someone, I got a great Miami premiere story for you guys that I'll maybe tell you if we have time or I'll come back. But even at that premiere where I was like, that actually it was the second time I saw it. There was a Los Angeles premiere. So the second premiere, the one in Miami, I had folks come up to me who had no problem at all telling me what their problems with the movie was. And I just wanted to smack them.
Wait, the audacity,
the audacity, you know, the audacity.
Yeah, just random. random folks, you know, who like thought, who were expecting a certain kind of thing and didn't get it. You know,
I also think people in Miami like really have a like connection to the TV show, so like they literally have shaped their city around the TV show, and so there's a very strong expectation that it has to be like the TV show.
Yeah. Yeah. And then maybe something in the marketing happened. I don't know. Like, you know, because it was like those people were invited. So like, who were those people? And why did the people who invited them think they would be good theater goers to start spreading the word of mouth? You know, so
right.
Like, maybe like, you know, again, it just was something that, and that's to answer your question. I'm just so, I'm excited. I'm like so stoked that it's getting its due, because it's obvious that whatever, however it was received, there was some filter
Yes.
Right.
There that prevented folks from really seeing the film for what it is.
Yeah.
And now that filter is gone and people are seeing it because they really want to see it. They're seeing it because other folks who have seen it without that filter have recommended it, and they're appreciating those great qualities that Michael has as an artist and as a filmmaker that he has embodied the movie with, and took a bunch of crazy knuckleheads like myself along for the ride to help tell that story.
Well, you might not be as connected with it, but people are, and any one of our listeners in our community, like, they adore this movie and largely adore it because of your performance. Like, Jose Hierro is the man. And so we have not told any of our listeners as we're recording this that we're about to talk to you, but when we do announce it in our community, they are going to lose their fucking minds, and I am here for it. And this has just been so joyful. We could probably talk to you for like so many hours, but we've kept you so long. But I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for your time. We are such gigantic fans of yours. And this has just been, I mean, a treat. And Katie harassing you at an event to make this happen is my now like one of my favorite memories of doing this show that we do together. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks right back. You know, I'm having a time of my life talking to you guys, so much so that I'm not even looking at the clock and realizing that we've been talking for much more than what we probably set out to talk to. But I can easily continue talking for more hours, and it's not necessarily because I like talking about myself. It's just because I like talking to other people who appreciate the same things that I do, and we find some commonality in that, and through that other things are discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what life is all about and should be about, you know. So that's what's happening here, and I would love to come back. Katie?
Oh, we would love to have you.
We've got there's like 20 other Public Enemies, Black. I mean, if you think another movie's been reclaimed, Black Hat has been reclaimed.
Black
on
Hat
a level
has been reclaimed.
That is insane. So there's so much more that we could talk about. But we can definitely try and line up another chat because this has been too much fun. We've been spoiled with you. This has been great.
Yeah, and thank you so much. And Katie, thanks for harassing me.
It was a nice harassment. It was a loving harassment.
It was as respectful and as cordial as any harassment should be.
Thank you for saying that. I'd had just enough of the Spirit Awards daytime bourbon to make that introduction.
I'm so happy you did.
Okay,
really,
good.
I really am. Thank you so much for that. Really.
Well,
I owe you that Miami Vice
premiere story.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, don't forget.
So I won't forget.
All right, Katie, we're back.
Ugh, love him.
Love him.
Our new best friend.
New best friend, John Ortiz.
Yep.
Promising to come back to talk more about Miami Vice. And then we are going to harass him about Public Enemies. And obviously, if he does come back, we'll harass him about Black Hat too. He's like, I love Michael Mann. I would do anything for him. I mean, just the positive energy that he gave me and the contact high of talking to him today has just been crazy.
I know. And it's clear that he really wants to talk about what a huge, you know, moment in his career this film was for him. And that maybe, you know, with the reception of the film in 2006, he didn't get the opportunity to do that. And I also think that looking back on it 20 years later gives him the chance to really reflect on that. But I did not realize that it was such a, you know, turning point for him going from theater to film and television. And so it is nice for him to talk about it and kind of reflect on it.
And it's so warm, but it's almost like heartbreakingly so, him talking about his dearly departed friend, Phil Hoffman, and going and saying, I want my PTA. Like, imagine your buddy.
I loved that.
Imagine your buddy, like, I want my PTA. You got your PTA. I want my PTA. And Michael Mann seems like a guy that could be my PTA. And I'm like, you know what? Hell yeah, John.
You
Ortiz.
Have to have that hell belief.
Yeah.
Like,
hell yeah.
You know, that I think Michael Mann could be my Paul Thomas Anderson.
I know.
I love it. Yeah, and guess what? He kind of is.
Yeah, he really, like, four times.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the universe is good, which I feel like it is,
mm-hmm.
there's got to be a little bit of John Ortiz in Heat too.
Yeah. I mean,
come on.
Come on.
There's a John Ortiz. There are multiple continents of John Ortiz level roles that are just begging Michael Mann to cast him. I feel like it's an easy choice. Get an absolute murderer to come in and just hit a home run in like a three-line role, John Ortiz, you know?
Exactly. He can play like a DA or something.
He can play a DA. He can play a bank robber. He can play a crook. He can play anything. He can do
anything.
Literally anything.
You know what? He could be like, you know, oh, well, I don't want to spoil Heat 2. Never mind. I was going to suggest
this is another fan casting. But
I know.
If, you know, after the amazing time that we had with John, if we are lucky enough to talk to him again, we will absolutely let you guys know. And, as I said, wrapping up to John himself, I could just feel the energy of Katie and I having the best time. And so we hope that you've had the best time listening to him, and we hope that we've covered it. I think his story of getting the role and that experience of working with Michael Mann and the detail and the, as he called it, the juicy stuff that made his role what it was is really cool. It's really cool.
I also just want to say that what I really loved hearing from him is, like, you know, the lore of this set has been so sort of skewed negative. Oh, it's a disaster. Oh, they had to change the ending, the hurricanes, you know, Colin, Jamie, all this stuff has been very, like, sort of stressful seeming. And while he doesn't say that it wasn't stressful, I love that he talks about what good friends they all became, and that they're still friends, and that they bonded through kind of like, oh my God, there's a hurricane, these work stoppages, you know, things are happening, things are changing. But, like, that really bonded that group of actors. And I love that he talks about how he's still friends with all of them. And it really seems like he has good memories of it. It's not, oh my God, that was crazy, I had a miserable time. It was like they went through something together and they all came out stronger for it. So I really loved hearing that kind of, like, warmth of, and I think that's just kind of the person that he is, but hearing his fond memories of all of that was really lovely.
And if you want to know how good John Ortiz is, when someone who's shooting second unit of him reacting to a scene and stops the camera and goes, man alive, that was good. Do that again. And I mean, that's the image. That's one of the images of Jose Year. And that's just John. That's John with the notes working with Michael Mann. And that's why they're just such a perfect pair. And you can tell why he's a guy that Michael Mann's like, oh yeah, I'll find a role for John Ortiz, because he can do anything. And he's someone I'm always so happy to see in every movie. And man alive,
same,
was it the best to see him in person today. And the story, you guys didn't see it, but the story about him wearing his own shirt to Barbie with his wife and son was so adorable.
We might have to do a little screenshot of that.
Might have to,
Just Jose Euro shirt.
Jose Euro shirt. Whoever designed that shirt and sent it to John, you did heroic work. That's awesome.
I mean, we need a full run. I need one of those.
I need one of those too. All right, guys, we will catch you again soon on another episode of Miami Nice or this little modern man campfire. It might be another Ferrari Nice, might be a Collateral Confessions. Who knows? But this is the modern man campfire. We're keeping you excited. We're keeping you on your toes. And we might even double up with another episode with John Ortiz if we're insanely lucky. Who knows?
We got to get that premiere story.
I want that premiere story so bad. Oh my God, I want it so bad. But, you know, we'll get it. I'm extremely confident we're going to get it.
I think we want him over.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we work for Jose Euro. It's clear. It's just yes, you know, we're doing a run. We've done a run. We'll go with these guys again.
We have many more loads. We have many more loads to deliver.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.